Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. North and South America and all the ships at sea. Let's go to press. Our guest today is Bob Thomas, author of a fascinating book called Winchell, published by Doubleday. Bob Thomas, welcome to Those Were the Days.
Well, thank you, Chuck. I'm glad to be here.
Bob, we like to reminisce a lot about the good old days of the golden age of radio, and aside from the comedy and the dramatic portions of radio as we remember them fondly, a very important part of radio was Walter Winchell, and he's the subject of your great book, which is fascinating reading, and I'd like to explore the radio personality of Walter Winchell with you for a few moments today.
Well, fine, Chuck. I go back as far as his network experience in my memory, because I can remember when he was on the old Lucky Strike program, and he just sort of came on during the musical portions and did his bit, I think, maybe 3 to 5 minutes, and then the music continued. But he was so galvanizing, so vital, that naturally he would have a future on his own show, and that came soon afterward in the mid-30s.
Mm-hmm. Was that Lucky Strike? Was that his first radio thing?
No, he had done something in the late 20s. William Paley had thought that he might be an interesting radio personality because he was becoming so popular with his Broadway column that Paley thought he would do okay on radio. Winchell, oddly enough, did not. He thought that his voice was too high-pitched, that he spoke too fast for radio. And you don't remember, but in those days, radio required a kind of sonorous, mellifluous voice, particularly in the field of news. Mm-hmm. And you had the deep-voiced announcers like Norman Brokenshire and Graham McNamee and others who when they did news, did it in a very formal style. And Winchell really didn't think he was suited for radio. He was, though.
Well, Winchell was, he really was the biggest booster of Walter Winchell of all time. And I'm surprised that he would think that perhaps he wouldn't work on radio. I would think that a man like Winchell, with just being overwhelmed with his own confidence, would think, certainly I could attack radio and go with it.
I think that's the only element of humility I ever discovered in the Winchell saga.
He was on for Jergens Journal, I think, for, good grief, how long?
I think 32 years or thereabouts. It was a long association and a very happy one for Jergens, because Winchell was smart enough, and maybe the Jergens people had this in mind too, that he identified himself with Jergens, so that he was identified with his product more than any other star in radio, because he would use things like the Jergens Journal. Mm-hmm. And with lotions of love, so that he would throw in these things that would stick in the listener's mind. And, of course, Jergens became the most widely used hand lotion in the nation because of that.
Now, in your book, you make reference to the fact that at the end of, nearing the end of Winchell's radio career, Jergens wanted him to go on for a different product of theirs.
Yes, it was deodorant, and he just didn't go for this at all. At that time, Jergens was sponsoring both himself and, in the 15 minutes following, Luella Parsons. So he said, well, throw that deodorant to Parsons. Well, naturally, Jergens wanted to push it with their number one man, and they had falling out.
And that was it.
Yeah, of course it was good for him, because he went on to make much more money with other sponsors.
Mm-hmm. How did he get the stories for his radio broadcast? I know he had a great pipeline of information flowing because of the widely syndicated column. Incidentally, how many papers was he in at the peak?
800.
800?
Yes. I don't think any other columnist has ever equaled that record.
Well, did that give him pretty much of a built-in supply of source material?
Sure. That? He had hundreds, maybe thousands of legmen. Mm-hmm. All over the nation, all over the world for that matter, because everybody wanted to plant a story with Walter Winchell. He had only one paid employee, he always bragged, Rose Bigman, who was his girl Friday. But in truth, he was paying some other people to write things for him. But most of all, he had this core of Broadway press agents on whom he relied to a great extent. And they were a very talented bunch. Many of them went on to become famous writers on their own in Hollywood and elsewhere. And one of them is the head writer for Lucy right now, Milt Josephsberg. So that he had these very clever young people who were feeding him material, not only for their own clients, because he demanded that they give him five free items, meaning items that they had picked up along Broadway, for one item of their own. So he had that core, then he had all the Hollywood press agents who were eager to plant things with him, both for the column and radio, and he had political figures up to and including President Roosevelt, who fed him material and used him as a pipeline to the nation. So there was never any problem with his getting material.
Now, you mentioned the free items. It's explained beautifully in the book, and you mentioned it a few times, and I enjoyed it. But exactly what would Winchell consider a free item as opposed to a so-called paid item?
Well, a free item was one which the press agent was not being paid to submit to Winchell. In other words, it was about somebody else's client, or about some figure in the news who, a political figure or someone who didn't have a press agent, perhaps. So that Winchell knew that these items were independent, and these fellows would really struggle to get hot stuff. Unfortunately, Winchell did not often check his items. And if his items sound good and logical, he'd run to the microphone or to his column and use it. And as a result, he had a high ratio of wrongos.
Now, he was he was pretty smart in that he didn't take he put the responsibility for the accuracy of these things on the network or the sponsor or even the newspapers, didn't he?
Well, he would not indemnify himself against libel. He insisted that Hearst and ABC or the Red Network, I see he was on the Blue Network for NBC, would have to take out an insurance policy. And that got to be very expensive for Hearst and the networks. And in the end, I think it was part of his undoing because he became rather irresponsible. And these networks just could not afford the luxury of paying Winchell's legal fees. Mm-hmm.
What about Winchell's drop-dead list?
Well, that was one method he used to discipline the people who fed him material, and it was very effective. If he caught someone in a wrong-o, or if he, fell out with some pressing, he would put them on the drop-dead list. There was another more profane version of that list, but he would use it for a six-month period when they would be in a kind of Broadway Siberia. Uh-huh. And they could not feed material to Winchell during this period, and it was a period of sufferance for these poor press agents. They would find ways of getting around it, such as feeding their material through another press agent who was in good graces with Winchell. But at the end of that 6 months, Rose Bigman, a girl Friday, would call him up and said, you can start submitting again.
Gee, that's really amazing. He would do that just like a little taskmaster.
Yeah, but it encouraged accuracy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That's what he was looking for most of the time, although on the other hand, he didn't care very much sometimes. As long as it sounded logical, he'd run the thing.
Yeah, and he was afraid if he checked an item, it might ruin it.
He didn't often like to print a correction or a retraction either, did he?
Oh, no, he hated that. Nobody likes to be told that they're wrong, you know, and he'd find ways of getting around it. He would say, don't believe those silly rumors about Liz and Richard. Uh-huh. Now, the reader would maybe not have too good a memory to remember that last week Winchell had printed the silly rumor about Liz and Richard.
That's great. What about his radio audience? You said he was a very he was great sponsor identification with Juergens, but he had probably one of the largest radio audiences for the longest period in the history of radio.
Yes, I think so, and he was almost unique in his field because there was no other newscaster who came within light years of Winchell mm-hmm. and his rating. He was very strong through the 30s. Oddly enough, his strongest period came about 1948, when during much of the season he was the number one top-rated show on the air. And this was during a period when he was beginning to fall into a decline as far as popularity was concerned, because he was becoming more and more of a right-winger and was espousing some causes which were not popular mm-hmm. with the vast audience which he had commanded.
He set up headquarters more or less in the Stork Club in New York, and he was great friends for a long, long time with Sherman Billingsley. Now, what about the... And Billingsley, of course, was the owner of the Stork Club. What was the scene? Can you draw us on radio a picture of the scene at the Stork Club where Winchell would hold forth?
Yes, it was more or less the focal point of the entire nightlife of New York. And the focal point of that focal point was Table 50 in the Cub Room mm-hmm. of the Stork Club. And Billingsley was a smart operator. He was a former bootlegger out of Oklahoma and served some time in prison. And he came to New York and he started the Stork Club after having run a speakeasy. And Winchell became fond of it and plugged it. And Billingsley catered to Winchell when Winchell started worrying about a gangster assassination in one of the barbershops that he had frequented. Billingsley put in his own barber chair where Winchell could get his hair cut and a shave anytime he wanted. When Winchell complained that the noise of the rumba band was a little too great for him to talk, and Winchell loved to talk, Billingsley put up a glass partition between the band and Winchell. And then he built the Cub Room just so Winchell could have some privacy from the other patrons, because he would be bothered by the normal run of patron whom he just didn't want to have any truck with. So he had his own domain, the Cub Room, where only the really top figures of the political world, the show world, and the underworld could come. And the greats of those worlds would pass by Table 50, just hoping that Winchell would recognize them, engage them in conversation, and maybe they could drop an item in Winchell's lap. And the following morning, if they were lucky, they might make the lead item of Winchell's column, or maybe his broadcast. And that would be enough to sustain them for 6 months if they were in show business.
And also the press agents, really, if they couldn't plant an item with Winchell on the radio or in his column, they had a pretty good chance of possibly losing their jobs.
Oh, yeah, they were virtually out of business. They would be hired with instructions by a band leader, by a star, anybody. And said, I want, most of all, to get in Winchell's column. And if these fellows could get an orchid from Winchell, man, that was the equivalent of the Nobel Prize.
That was a regular feature in his... Did he use that on the radio, too, the orchid?
Yes, he used it in different forms, but whenever he cited something, whether it was a restaurant in Manhattan, a new movie, a book which he plugged, that was immediate success. And he was the making of many, many millionaires.
Which brings us to the power of Walter Winchell. He was a man who had a considerable amount of power. He was as powerful as anyone was in the country, for sure, and possibly in the world. He could make or break a person just by an item or two, a regular item or two in his column or on the radio. Is that not right?
Oh, certainly. I don't think anybody, and I'm not saying this just because I wrote a book about Walter Winchell, I don't think anyone in American history wielded as much power over the American public as did Walter Winchell, because he had a two-pronged thrust into the American consciousness. He had this column, which was printed in the New York Mirror and in 800 other newspapers, and was read more than any other columnist, more than any other feature in any newspaper, even the comics. Then he had this radio show, which everyone listened to on Sunday night, and there were jokes about it. You know, if you didn't have a radio, just throw up your window and you could hear Walter Winchell, because the streets were empty on Sunday night, and they just sat glued to every word that he said. Well, that's enormous power. And it was power at a time when, you know, he had no competition. It's hard to imagine such power today because there is so much media. Uh-huh. There's so much assault on the American public, both visually and in their audible senses. So much pulling at the sleeve of the poor American public that I think people turn off nowadays. They have so many commercials on television. They see signboards. Everyone is trying for their attention. And in Winchell's time, he had it. Today, I don't think anyone can command that kind of attention.
A good example of Winchell's power, as outlined in your book, Winchell, is what he did for... Was it Olson and Johnson?
Yes.
In their Hell's a Poppin' show on Broadway.
Right. Well, Olson and Johnson were old vaudevillians, and I remember I used to love them on the old Fanchon and Marcos circuit, but they were kind of over the hill, and they had this wild idea of taking their crazy review into New York, and nobody gave them a chance. Mm-hmm. But Winchell loved it, because he liked the old-time hoke. He was right out of vaudeville himself. And the other critics on Broadway just poo-pooed the whole notion. But he got on the air, he plugged it in his column, and he made that show a hit. And in its time, it ran for 5 years. It had three or four road shows. It sponsored several sequels, Sons of Fun, a movie version. And Olson and Johnson ended up being millionaires many times over just because Winchell had embraced their show. And I plugged it to the nation.
All right, now that's a good example of someone that Winchell built. Tell us about someone, perhaps, that Winchell just devastated.
Well, this destructive element of Winchell's psyche, I don't think came on until later in his career. During the 30s and into the mid-40s, he was very constructive about the things that he liked. The things that he attacked were highly vulnerable and good enemies for him. And I mean Adolf Hitler. And he attacked Hitler at a time when it was not entirely fashionable in this country. Mm-hmm. There were many newspapers, many people in high office who thought that maybe Hitler was doing good in Germany, even though he was kicking around the Jews. At least he was fighting off the communists. And he was getting the economy of Germany back on an even keel. But Winchell saw through Hitler from the very beginning and attacked him. He attacked the native fascists, the German boond, the hate merchants like Gerald L.K. Smith. And I think this is something that no one can detract from Winchell. He did a marvelous piece of public relations for America against its enemies, both abroad and at home. And Roosevelt recognized this and embraced Winchell as a spokesman. So that during those years, he never really attacked anyone who was a native, who was trying to do good works. I think it was during that the late 40s and 50s that he fell into this trap of using his power to defend himself. Mm-hmm. And I can't think of anybody he really broke, not anyone important at least. There were a couple of disc jockeys who took him on, you know, Barry Gray, and he tried to ruin Barry Gray, but Gray survived. There was another one, Sam Gyson, who did not survive and was run out of New York. And but other than that, I can't think of anybody he really ruined who was an innocent victim of mm-hmm. his spleen.
He did have some vendettas, though, and he was the big columnist who went after Margaret Truman, I think.
Oh yeah.
And that was pretty famous. That was Truman, I think, wrote a letter to a music critic.
Yes, that was Paul Hume, the Washington Post, and certainly Truman did not like Winchell, although he just disregarded him at first, which Winchell resented because he had an entree to the White House during the Roosevelt period. But Truman didn't understand this fast-talking Broadway character. Uh-huh. Truman was a Missouri rustic, and he just didn't cater to Winchell. Winchell resented it and became anti-Truman and printed things such as that Margaret Truman had had a nose job and just ridiculed her soprano, which was pretty fair game because she wasn't much of a singer. But he wasn't able to destroy Margaret Truman.
No.
He tried his best, but he couldn't defeat Harry Truman. And, you know, he had this long feud with Ed Sullivan, but Sullivan survived. Many of Winchell's enemies thrived despite him.
I wanted to ask you about the Sullivan feud. Woven almost throughout your book is the feud between Ed Sullivan and Walter Winchell. How did that exactly begin? When did that start?
Well, they both worked on the New York Graphic, which was a wild, wonderful tabloid in the 20s. And Winchell was the Broadway columnist. He later moved on to other things, other papers. And then Sullivan was elevated from the sports field to the Broadway columnist. And his first column was a very self-righteous, upstanding editorial that he would not demean the Broadway scene as some others had in that field. And naturally, Winchell thought this meant him, which mm-hmm. it probably did. So one night they had an encounter in a restaurant, and Winchell said, okay, Ed, are you ready to apologize? And Sullivan, who had a pretty flashing Irish temper, said, apologize? Why, you blankety-blank, if you talk to me again, I'm going to take you downstairs and stuff your head in the toilet. Well, that was the start. And from then on, for a good almost 40 years, theirs was the biggest feud on Broadway. It was more or less of a one-sided feud because Sullivan's bosses in the Daily News said, well, why publicize a competitor? Mm-hmm. The Daily News was the big paper, and the Mirror was the number two. So they would take out the snide remarks that Sullivan put in his column about Winchell. And this frustrated Winchell because he was printing all this terrible stuff about Sullivan, but Sullivan wouldn't answer it. But in private, they did, and it was a brutal fight.
It was a long one, and wasn't there one time on Sullivan's show on television then that it wasn't on Sullivan. I'm trying to recall exactly from your book. He got on, he was a guest. Ed Sullivan was a guest on someone else's program.
Barry Gray's show.
On Barry Gray.
Right. And this was right after the Josephine Baker incident. And for your listeners who don't remember that, it was an occasion when Josephine Baker, who was a Negro entertainer, a very famous one, and one who had been promoted by Winchell, went into the Star Club and got rotten service. And I think it was intended because Billingsley was a bigot, and he didn't like Jews and too many Jews coming into his Star Club, even though Winchell himself was a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And he certainly would not tolerate Negroes in there, although he had to admit people like Josephine Baker. So they just got poor service, and Baker got upset and stalked out. And the next night she went to Barry Gray and poured out her story. And then Sullivan got in the act, and he got on the air and gave the most bitter tirade against Walter Winchell that ever had been given before, and called him an ignoramus, and a man who was trying to tell people how to vote, and he had never voted himself. Mm-hmm. He was trying to advise people on international politics, and he'd never been to Europe. and that he was just a blight on the American scene. And this was quite an eye-opener for most people, because here on television, Sullivan was presenting this rather benign appearance as the warm MC, and then he came on with this just bitter tirade against Mitchell, and it just broke the feud wide open once more.
Now, Sullivan, as you just said, accused Winchell of not having voted, and indeed Winchell hadn't voted, I guess, at all. And I love the line in your book about the way Winchell replied to this. He listed in his column, I guess, half a dozen people who hadn't registered.
Right, he said J. Edgar Hoover had never voted for a president because of the fact that he lived in the District of Columbia. And he said, well, what about Douglas MacArthur? He never voted because he was off serving his country. Mm-hmm. You know, these arguments were a bit odd, but...
And Winchell's excuse was what? What did he say about... Well, he was too busy...
He was too busy protecting Mr. and Mrs. America to worry about going to the polls. He had an answer for everything.
What is Walter Winchell doing today?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. He's in Arizona?
Yes, he lives in Scottsdale. And this, I think, is the tragedy of the man's life. That here he commanded the attention of the nation and was hyperactive all of his career. It was a driving force behind this man. And all of a sudden, he suffers a couple of personal tragedies. He lost his son, who committed suicide. Then he lost his wife, to whom he had reconciled in her last few years. He was estranged from his daughter. He lost his voice in Manhattan because the Mirror was killed. And then the amalgam of several papers to which he went died. And suddenly he was without a voice in his own home city, the city that he had virtually ruled like an emperor.
Mm-hmm.
He felt that the nation had passed him by. Radio was dead, network radio at any rate. He couldn't make a go of it in television. And he became very depressed. And he sits down in his mansion in Arizona and doesn't see his old friends, doesn't take phone calls from his former buddies. I don't know what he's doing. And I don't know what his reaction was to this book. I know that he's seen it because his girl Friday asked for copies. As to his reaction to it, I haven't the vaguest notion.
Well, our reaction to your book, Winchell, published by Doubleday, was a very positive one. We enjoyed it very much, and we urge all of our listeners who enjoyed reminiscing with you today about Walter Winchell and who will enjoy the Walter Winchell tape we've got coming up to grab a copy of Winchell by Bob Thomas. And thank you for spending a while with us today, Bob Thomas, on Those Were the Days.
Well, thank you, Chuck. And with lotions of love, I remain your Hollywood correspondent, Bob Thomas, who knows that there is a broken heart for every life on Broadway.
Great.